Greetings to everyone, both near and far. I hope you're doing well today. I'm Henrik Fagdén from Sweden, and we welcome you to another edition of Red Eyes Radio, the program dedicated to investigating and re-examining both history, ancient and modern. We also study conspiracies, the geopolitical chessboard, and many, many other topics that we find to be not only intriguing, but also important to know more about. RedEyesCreations.com and RedEyesMembers.com. That's the websites where you can learn more. And don't forget to follow along in our news section and, of course, subscribe to our RSS feeds as well. Sophia Smallstorm is with us today to talk about her recent presentation called Sandy Hook Unraveled on the conspiracy behind what we've been told was the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting by Adam Lanza. She's probably best known for her research on 9/11, which culminated in the documentary 9/11 Mysteries that she has talked with us about previously. She's also noted for the tie-in between chemtrails and synthetic biology. The Sandy Hook shootings caught her interest because the story has not only expanded in an artificial way since its inception, but for those who, not only like herself, have closely examined this event, have realized that there is a whole lot of theatrics involved. Welcome back, Sophia, to the program. Thanks for coming on with us again. It's nice to talk to you. How have you been?
I've been very well, Henrik. I had kind of a very strange prolonged flu, and so I might cough a little now and then because I'm just getting out the other end of it.
No worries. That's all good. Now, your presentation on Sandy Hook is just, I mean, it's very, very interesting. Well done. I mean, you ask some great question about what really happened and point to some of the grave inconsistencies in this event, and it really just shows that something very, very fishy is going on. So what I thought we could do is to kind of backtrack a little bit. It's been a little bit over a year now since this event occurred. It might not be fresh in people's minds. Maybe you can just remind us again here at the outset of what we've been told of what actually happened from the official outlets, and then we can go in and talk about your version of this a little bit.
Well, again, let's not call it my version. I did compile information that I found very interesting in my presentation, which can be seen on YouTube. I guess you've already told everybody the title. So there were things that I discovered on my own that I added to it, and then I also included that angle about dimensions because I wanted to speak to people in a new way so that they could try to follow this kind of on another level, not just the anomalies. You can analyze anomalies and find them until the cows come home, as the expression goes.
Yeah.
And you'll never satisfy everybody out there who is a doubting Thomas and deliberately keeps poking and prodding, poking and prodding. So we were officially told that it was a mass shooting at an elementary school in Connecticut, and that a kid who was on psychiatric medications barged into the school in spite of the state-of-the-art security system and took out 26 people, 20 children, and 6 adults in 2 classrooms only. And then he shot himself. And he had shot his mother at home before he drove this black Honda Civic to the school and got in. So that's pretty much the official report, and that was December 14th last year.
Yep.
And I remember when it happened, I was actually attending a little group meeting. We had a little activist group meeting in a restaurant, and everybody was on their iPads, and they were all, you know, twiddling around looking at what had just happened in Connecticut. And immediately a wall went up in me. We tend to do this. We who know better, we wall ourselves off from the official reports. We immediately jump into the position of skeptic. And as the news unfolded and I got to hear more about it and see internet reports and news and this and that, it was clear to me that I certainly didn't know what happened there and that this was going to take some time figuring out.
Indeed. Now, very interesting. I think you go through some of the history of Newtown in the beginning, which is kind of sets the framework in a really good way. I think it shows, some of the activities that's been going on there in the past. Why don't you just tell us what kind of town it is and you know, how it sprang up and what it's consequently developed into, Sophia?
Well, again, I am speaking generally of Fairfield County and all of the environs around New York City. There have been, you know, there's been a concerted effort to make the suburbs more glamorous. These were actually all rural areas to start with. The city was the city, and then it became the suburbs. Farmland pretty much disappeared. But I did have the opportunity to live on the state line of New York and Connecticut many years ago, and I would frequent Fairfield County because it was basically my backyard. And I have since learned and observed, and I've been back to that part of the country, changes that have occurred. I mean, it's all very ritzy now. Greenwich, Connecticut is extremely affluent, and all the coastal towns are. And Newtown is it's on the other side of the county. It's not coastal. And we're speaking of Fairfield County here. It's the largest municipality in Fairfield County. And Sandy Hook is this tiny little enclave within it. And if you watch my presentation, and one of the things I hinted at that I didn't exactly expand on, and of course you understand I gave this presentation live at ConspiracyCon where I was held to an hour and 15 minutes maximum, and even that was generous.
Yeah.
So I had to just make, you know, abbreviate certain things. But Sandy Hook is a very tight, very close-knit community in Newtown. And it is so tight now that if you try to go to Sandy Hook, you'll be kicked out. Someone will appear immediately and will tell you to leave. And these will be people who appear to be residents. They'll say, we don't want strangers here. So you have to ask yourself, what has gone on there over the, you know, past 60 years? And this is where in my presentation I suggest that this is a model town. And I don't know where and how it got the name Newtown. I'm not a historian to that extent. But it is now literally a new kind of town. We are seeing an Agenda 21 unfolding going on. We're seeing a new kind of population. This is the modeling that I'm talking about in the presentation, where you accept tragedy. You even embrace it because it's going to make you bigger and stronger in your heart and soul. And you will take the loss of wealth. You will take the relinquishing of freedoms, even bereavement, loss of your loved ones, because it shows what kind of metal you are made of. So there's a whole new kind of character that Americans are being asked to develop as deceptions and loss and assault are being engineered all around them and levied at them.
Right. So it's been called a transition town as well for these purposes. The people come into the community to better themselves, right? To build their character, and then they're, you know, if they've experienced something which is, you know, hardship or difficulty, and then they move on from there. Is that correct?
Right. Overall, you know, we all experience ups and downs in our lives. But when we experience them as a community, America is now beginning to model community strength. And this is actually you could call it modern, you could call it New Age, you could call it socialist, Marxist, you know, it's like the people are all one. This is the new world order. This is eventually going to be, we are one in the face of independence even. So it's really the making of the hive.
Huh. So we have other programs tying, and this is something I want to return to a little bit later in more detail perhaps, in terms of Baha'i faith and everything that actually occurred after the events and all that. We'll get to that later, but just to preface on this a little bit, the basic program coming out of Agenda 21 is something that has been kind of part of the building of this new town. And I guess the way that you see it as well then is that it's symbolically and maybe even ritually, if you will, an experiment, a real-time live experiment which involves the very events of Sandy Hook, the shooting that we're also going to talk about, correct?
Right. I mean, I'm considering that we are already talking about these things because I don't want to piece this interview into what I think happened versus what really happened and then what it really means. I want to just do it all at the same time.
Right.
In Newtown, what I think we're seeing is a modeling going on. You use the word ritual, and that's a great word, but the people are actually demonstrating what should be done. It hit me, Henrik, a couple of months ago that the television models for us. Now I'm seeing people with huge numbers of piercings and tattoos and all kinds of weird hairstyles on the Food Network. The chefs are they're just like blackened with tattoos, and they've got all kinds of weird earrings and lip piercings, and you'd never see this on TV 40 years ago, you know?
Right.
Even though there were people like that. And I think this is all modeling. We are being encouraged to become weirder and weirder and accept everyone. And of course these are subtly, they're really modeling a departure from the staid and ordinary. The radicalism is about fracturing family and promoting the same sex, gender pairing, you know, that kind of thing. So
it's the new radicals, as what is his name again, who wrote that? Obama's mentor?
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
What was his name again? Jesus, I can't believe I'm forgetting
isn't
that.
Isn't it terrible? Once you become older, you just have these lapses of memory, and I can't help you.
I'm not that old, but I'll think about it.
I know exactly who you mean. He's that I think it begins with an A. There's an A in it.
No, let me see. Okay, let me do the rules for radicals. It's, of course, Olinsky. It's Saul Olinsky.
Yeah, I told you it begins with A.
There you go.
That's the best I could do. So anyway, all right. So Sandy Hook, when I talk about the modeling, the event, it's actually an ongoing event. And here's where I want to bring in the IPAWS drills. You know, we didn't have the language a year ago when it happened in terms of the research that people were doing to see that this was a Homeland Security drill, a very high level drill. And I'm just saying, let me just be as expansive as possible. In all probability, that's what it was. It was what they call an integrated capstone event, a very high level, extreme reality, pyramidic drill organized with multiple teams. Within each team, there's a pyramid also. So you've got the all-knowing ones at the top of the organized event, and that would be the all-seeing eye at the top of the pyramid, right?
Right.
And then each team that they incorporate, and the teams are all the entities that would respond to a catastrophic event. It would include police, it would include state police, highway patrol, hospitals, EMTs, media, just about anyone you can think of who's called in. For instance, I spoke to a man recently who's a phenomenal investigator, and he's on to Sandy Hook. And he had called the, I think it's called LifeStar, that's the life flight equivalent medevac helicopter entity in that part of Connecticut. I think it's Danbury. And he said, why didn't you respond to Sandy Hook? And they said, we were never called. Now, they should have been called. And you have to ask yourself, why weren't they called? Well, because they weren't necessary, because if they came, you'd have to see some bodies carried out to the waiting helicopters, and this couldn't happen given the nature of this peculiar event. So they were left out altogether from this enormous catastrophe. So this was one team that wasn't actually included. But the other teams, they are all pyramidic. The top-notch people do know that this is an IPAWS event, an exercise. And the rest of the people at the lower of descending importance within that group, for instance, state police, they might not know. They might think it's real and kids did die, only we just can't get into the building.
Yeah, it's compartmentalized as always, and there's only just a few people, maybe even in the loop, but there seems to be more going on than that. But let's just kind of break that down a little bit and talk about some of the inconsistencies, the breach of protocol, the strange behavior of the people involved when they're interviewed, and all these things that occurred afterwards. Where should we begin? There's just so much of this.
Well, we can begin with what you said, the breach of protocol. I was talking to a friend, and he's a lawyer, and he's very, very bright, and he just told me early on in Sandy Hook, you just can't, you know, being legally trained, he knew that only a doctor can pronounce people dead, or some high-level person, medical professional, and it's usually at a hospital. So that started me in the direction of some poking around on the internet, and I found that there were actual ER professionals who had commented, you know what, we get code blue people in the emergency room all the time. We get people who haven't even breathed in 20 minutes. And the whole idea is get them somewhere where there is medical capability and technology and try to get breath into them or out of them, you know. And then you pronounce them dead. But you have to expend every effort you can. And I also happened upon an ambulance team. They were having lunch. This is here in California. And so I strolled up to them, and I asked them about start triage because I had learned about that. And they said, oh, yeah. They said, everybody uses it. They said, we don't use it because we're not responding to mass casualty events ourselves. We're transferring people hospital to hospital, you know, one facility to another. But if you're a responder to what's called a mass casualty incident, an MCI, like a bus turning over, or airplane crash or something, or a school massacre like that, then you do have to follow start triage, and that is followed worldwide. You have these colored tarps that are put into use immediately that designate what kind of attention, immediate or delayed or minor, you know, not necessary even, people receive. And people are tagged on site as they are found with labels that would indicate that they have to be transported immediately to this mat because they are in critical care. So start triage is very useful, and it's used worldwide. And I've heard arguments that, oh, well, it just wasn't used at Sandy Hook. Not everyone uses it. But I'm very sorry. With an incident like this, you could poll 5,000 people in the ENT and paramedic and hospital business, the people who deal with this every day, and they would tell you, yes, they would have used start triage. There would be no other option. So, you know, what I see about Sandy Hook is that there are so many excuses that are made for it. For instance, the school had closed circuit video. It had a video system, but it didn't have video system with recording capability. And that's why there are no videos of Adam Lanza walking around inside. Well, excuse me, but it had a state-of-the-art video security surveillance system, and that didn't include recording capability? You can't have it both ways, you know?
Yeah.
And in Sandy Hook, there are just too many failures like this. I understand one failure or two where you have to make an excuse, but you can't have 150 of them. And I bet you if I had the time or inclination, I with a couple of friends could write down dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of these things.
Yeah.
And you'd have to make an excuse for all of them, and that just doesn't fly.
Which makes it coincide with some of the other past events that we've seen with drills and everything else intended to confuse the procedure of the protocols. The people involved are not quite, you know, sure what's going on. But okay, if we just play devil's advocate for a little bit, could it be that this is so traumatizing and shocking of an event, so out of the ordinary, that this kind of breach of protocol occurs and no one really knows what is going on, and everyone is running around like a headless chicken looking for someone of authority to tell them what to do? Is that possible?
No. You can't have the life flight helicopters not called and nobody thinks about that. I mean, that's an instruction. That's not, oh, so-and-so forgot to call life flight or medevac or life star or whatever. And And what? You, how many people are there? You think they're all going to forget that? No.
No.
But what's strange is the people who operate that particular evacuation methodology in that part of Connecticut, why? I'm sure they're asking the question, why weren't we called? And then you're told, well, because everybody was already dead, so there was no point. Well, sorry, but you still have to get them out of there. So, well, the police took care of that. The coroner took care of that in the middle of the night in a refrigerated van in the, you know, darkness. And one of the things that this wonderful witness, Wolfgang Halbig, he is a Florida, he was a school administrator, school principal, and he has a perfect credential. They dovetail. They're, you know, he is the perfect Sandy Hook, you could say, perfect person to question and comment on Sandy Hook, because he's a Florida state trooper, former, he's retired now, and now he consults in school safety. Jim Fetzer just did a recent interview with him, radiofetzer.blogspot.com, and then I talked to him personally a day later. And this guy is all over the Sandy Hook issue. He is saying, I saw so many catastrophes at school, because not only was he a responder, he was a Florida state trooper, he was a homicide investigator for Florida Highway Patrol, state trooper, and he was a school administrator, principal. He said, you cannot stop parents. Once parents come to the site of something like that, they are climbing the fence, they are tearing the walls down to get in there and grab their kids themselves, dead or alive, you know?
Yeah.
And this is the parental instinct. I'm not a parent, but I've seen this. You go to a ball game in a park, and the parents, they have to be held down there.
Yeah, that's a very interesting, you know, kind of what happened there with the parents, and where's the, I mean, the basic thing that we're getting to here is that there has been no bodies presented. You, what you go through in the video is that the triage, the start, simple triage, and rapid treatment, they have these different tarps that you, you know, that they present and put people on depending on the urgency of how they need to be helped. None of that, as far as we've seen in the footage, has occurred. We haven't seen any of that.
Right. We haven't. There were no kids brought out because it was deemed unnecessary because they were all dead. This is what we're told. There were some adults. There was a vice principal. Her name was Natalie Hammond. And she was apparently wounded in the leg. And the story changes. You can find her if you search for her commentaries. You'll find conflicting and contradictory stories that she tells. I mean, she was shot through a closed door 4 times in the leg. She spent time in a wheelchair rehabilitating. But then suddenly her rehab was all over. I mean, when people are wounded that seriously, all up and down a leg, they show the signs of it often for many years. They're disabled, they have nerve damage, or they have musculoskeletal, you know, disrepair that has gone on, in a sense. I'm mangling the word, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Things don't heal perfectly. You don't just spring up at a hockey game and get interviewed by the media and tell them you're all fine now and you're a hero. And that's the other thing. We haven't heard from the heroes apart from one or two. So all of this is selective. But where are the children? The children who escaped? The children who survived? Why aren't they being made into heroes? We have one odd interview with that little boy. Dr. Oz interviews him, Louis. And Louis doesn't really know what to say. And if you look at the body language of the women around him, one of whom is, I think, his mother and the other one possibly the grandmother, you'll see that he's being stared down. It's very evident that people want him to say the right thing. And I have pictures of little Louis late in the day. You can see from the shadows he's at the firehouse with those same people. And why? If he was a rescue, he was a survivor, he was one of the kids who managed to run out of the building with his life, why are they keeping him at the firehouse at 5 o'clock that day? It doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't you get this kid home and get him away from the trauma? You don't stay on the scene. So there was something else going on.
Yeah. There were closed caskets, I believe you said as well. There was one that was open. But what did this say then about the parents? Is I mean, what is the bigger idea here? What's going on? Are they in on this? This is a test and a drill and experiment. They know this, or are they suffering and they have been traumatized and basically just told what to do and how to react?
Well, when you start really digging into who these people are, what these families are, I think you're going to find families that are not what we were told. These are the parents. You know, like paper dolls. These are the parents. These are the children. The children are 6 and 5. The parents are, whatever, 40 and 50. And the parents are really old to have 6-year-olds. And that's pretty much across the board except for the Parkers. But I think that the children were fictions in the sense that there are very few of them who are actually 6 years old today or were 6 years old on December 14th. I think that these children, many of them are grown up, and they appear at, for instance, the events, the after events themselves. And you see children who don't belong to those parents. For instance, when I mentioned to you the Super Bowl video, and we'll talk about that, there's a little girl. Her name is Avielle Richmond. She's a very pretty little girl from one of the Sandy Hook victims. But, you know, she has a very distinct face, an elfin face with curly brown ringlets. And you see the exact same face on this little girl who's singing at the Super Bowl 7 weeks later. These are 26 unnamed children from Newtown sent to sing at the Super Bowl. And they're in front of millions and millions of viewers who watch on TV, of course. And this little Avielle Richmond from Sandy Hook, one of the dead children, looks exactly like a girl who's singing at the Super Bowl. And then you start looking at the other kids and you go, wow, look at the similarities here. This one looks like Emily Parker, but 5 or 6 years older. This one looks like Grace McDonald. This one looks like Benjamin Wheeler. And you start picking out so much similarity between those kids and some of the Sandy Hook kids that you say, what is happening? And so some of the children may be a few years older today, but in the case of this little Richmond girl, her parents, as we were shown in the Sandy Hook story, were called the Hensel Richmond. It was a hyphenated name. I think the mom was Hensel and the father was Richmond. And so you see this little girl looks exactly like Avielle Richmond singing at the Super Bowl in New Orleans. And there are a lot of pictures of her in a gallery that one of the research people I know put up. And she's with a woman who has the same curly brown hair who looks like her real mother. So you got to say to yourself, okay, so the Hensel Richmond, the Hensel part of that parent couple can't be her mother. What's going on, Henrik? These are composite families. The families themselves seem to be fictitious.
You show in the video, and again, this people should take a look at this. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. We'll have it linked up on this program page, and just you know take a look through that because the images you know really scream out at you. And one of the interesting things is with Robert or Robbie Parker, I guess, which you show both some photos, which you know we'll get into more detail, but also the performance, really, the acting performance that it put on, the seconds before the feed, I guess, would go out live. Someone picked up the feed, and they basically show how he is getting into character. And when I saw that, it was like, what the bleep is going on there? You know, this is very bizarre, very strange, eerie to watch it, actually.
Right. And he ends his little speech with, our condolences, our meaning his and his wife, go to the family of the shooter as well, and that is really anomalous. I mean, we talk about parental, you know, reaction. That's very, very abnormal. You could call that extremely expansive and progressive, but I say that's part of the modeling, and that this is insincere.
Right.
And once again, Henrik, I don't know how that thing got out. That with that prelude where
I think if I can interject there on that a little bit, I believe it has to do with basically there was a whole movie produced like this. It was called Spin, And it was basically a guy who picked up the satellite feeds. I don't know if this is the case with this clip, but there's a way you can do that. They basically have the live feed going before they actually patch it out, if you will, to the actual channel, which means that people can actually see that stream, if you will. And that seems to be what that was. It might have just been, you know, they were actually running this live on the channel, which would be amazing if that was the case. But I suspect that it was just one of the pre-feeds before they actually, you know, patched him out, if you will.
Well, it could be what you said, but it also could be deliberate, just to get us going.
Why? Because I was thinking about that. When I saw the photos, I was like, why don't they just crop these photos so that you can't see these clues?
Because I think that there's a certain amount of oversight that will happen. I mean, in an event this large, with this many parts and this much ongoing aftermath, there's going to be tons of holes. But so it's almost like if you create some fodder for the, you know, pigeons to defend on, then everything is a big melee. And they knew that if it was done deliberately, they knew this was good for a lot of discussion. And it would keep us from looking at and talking about even other things, because there are a few big, if you plant a few really big pieces for people to jump on, then they're going, like you and I are talking about Robbie Parker. If it were up to me, I wouldn't talk about Robbie Parker because everybody talks about him.
Mm-hmm.
But in deference to the way that you've crafted the interview, you know, I'm going to take the opportunity to interject this little bit of possibility that we are given herrings and red herrings and blue herrings, to mangle another metaphor. But anyway, there's another thing I want to say, and I don't quite know how to put it. That Robbie Parker, if you try to find him, you can't find him. You can't find, there should be a body of information about him if he was a physician's assistant. But you can't find anything. You don't really know where he worked. He's very obscure. So, is it not safe to put a person who can't really be traced out in front of people and have him do something really weird like that, you know, and then have the whole world discussing it for years afterwards?
Yeah. Well, I have to say that, too, that I've seen this with other, you know, sting operations and false flag attacks and drills and everything else that, I mean, there's two possibilities in my mind here, and that's one, it's being done, but it's very, very poorly done. This would even include the contradictions in the media reporting, for example. Okay, granted, you have this idea that you want to be the first one who you know, pop the story, if you will. You want to get the scoop. You want to get it out there as quickly as possible, which diminishes the quality and the you know, verification of the sources and everything else. So sure, there could be you know, some inconsistencies in the quality of the reporting because of that. But nonetheless, it's very, very lousy done, which then suggests that, okay, either they're incompetent, or the second part is that they know what they're doing, and they just, what you said, they let some of these things slide. It's almost like they want people to find these clues. For those who ask the questions and are skeptical and everything, it's so blatantly obvious, and it is like, couldn't they do a better job in covering up some of these ideas? But then, or, you know, like the photos that you show with the daughters to Robert Parker, the legs are missing. It's almost screamingly obvious that this is a Photoshop job. They've cropped them in and inserted them. But then again, why not do that right and properly, right?
Right. I know. I don't understand that. I mean, the legs, it takes a while to see that, but when you see it, it's crazy that it's like that. And they can keep us busy talking about these kinds of things forever. And then they'll have people arguing about these things.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
As well.
Is that the point? I mean, it's kind of like with the Obama birth certificate when the layers in the PDF got out. It's like, oh God, this is such a poorly done thing that it's obvious that they want people to, like, you know, scream at the top of their lungs about how fake this is. And then you have the the true believers who never will, you know, look at the evidence, but they will defend it nonetheless. And then you have these factions really just going at it. You know what I mean?
Maybe it's a kind of insurance, because just to use the Obama birth certificate thing, because now my mind is going around with that. There are undoubtedly going to be people who say to their neighbor or their whatever coworker, did you know that Obama's birth certificate that they just presented is it's a fraud? You can look at the layers and you can see how they made it in the art file. And then the coworker will say, no, that's not possible. No. And they'll never look at it. But because they don't want to believe that it could be this bad, you know? So it's almost like they insure themselves, because it is worse than you could imagine. I mean, the wrong people are in power, and we let that happen. We went to sleep, all of that. It didn't happen yesterday.
No.
But there are still going to be so many people who cling to they're, you know, committed to not believe that. They don't want to go there. And so we'll waste our energy trying to present these kinds of dubiosity, fallacies to the public, our friends. And that somehow insures them against the stuff that we really discover that they did by oversight.
Mm-hmm. So this keep people occupied and tied up fighting with each other about the... Well, that shows also that the biggest battle is not with at the apex, if you will, of the pyramid. It's among, the people itself. It's kind of, just to make a quick analogy to that, is what they show in They Live, Carpenter's movie, when the guy's trying to hand over the glasses to the other guy and say, you know, please take a look at this. You'll see the evidence. Just put on the glasses and you'll see what I mean. And he just resists, and it's this long fighting scene where they're fighting ridiculously,
exactly,
almost at that point. That's what it's like.
Perfect. Yeah, because you're going to expend so much energy trying to get this person to put on the glasses, and let's say it took you a week to do that, and then you ended up losing the friendship with that person, and the person never even put on the glasses. Or he puts them on and he doesn't want to look through them. He shuts his eyes. But it's a week of your time. It's all that energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it further polarizes you against your fellow man. Because
yeah,
not everybody has the ego strength to take it on this level. And I say, I discovered this a couple of years ago, that they put out a false thesis for the public. And then they create a false antithesis for people that they know are not going to believe what's on the television. And there's something else beyond that. There's the true synthesis. But no one's going to find it, because the false thesis and the false antithesis are getting so much attention that it's very, very difficult to get to block out all that noise and get really dig deep. And let's, for the purpose of Sandy Hook, say that the false thesis is Adam Lanza massacred a bunch of kids, and he was on medications, and his mother took him to target practice and gave him guns, and he was emotionally unstable, and he had Asperger's and all of that. So the false antithesis might be, this was about gun control, it was deception, they used a mind-controlled person, he did this, people really died, it was satanic, there's a satanic church there, and... everybody's a Mason, and the Masonic Lodge is right behind the school. Okay, you know what? Many of those things are actually correct, that kids who are on psychiatric drugs are very likely prone to violence.
Oh,
all
sure.
The video games that we show, they're not incorrect, but they don't apply necessarily to this situation, because there's better stuff out there. When you look at the scale of these drills and the way that they're conducting fictions on television and the green screens and blue screens that they have, and, you know, then it becomes a deeper, more interesting weaving of possibilities. And that, to me, is beyond the limited hangout and the false thesis. So there's the false thesis, the false antithesis, but there's a much more interesting, bigger story to it, and that's what I try to look for. I call it the true synthesis. I don't even like the word true very much, but whatever. Other people seem to like it, so I'm using it here.
Right. So it's the use of the good old Hegelian dialectic. You polarize people, you divide and conquer. It's very easy to do it in that way, and it's a strategy that's worked for a really long time, so let's stick to it. But one of the things I want to mention that if this is the case, what you said with the planning and the fact that it's executed in the way that it's done, with even at the same time then even planting these cues out there for the people who want to look into it and kind of fall into the I guess what you would call the false solution to this or you know still part of the Hegelian dialectic. If that's the case, then it's brilliantly executed. I mean, even they're so good to even find such a good actor that he actually can play a lousy actor in front of the camera. You know what I mean? It's like,
yes.
Oh boy.
Yes. I mean, I think these are assignments. These are not really actors in the sense that actors do their thing well. They really do. These are assignments. These people have a task. They have a job. And they do it. And you see, the amazing thing is that chaos serves the purpose. If something goes wrong, it's just more chaos, and that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're right. And you can always use that. You can always use that environment to both, you know, shape and harness that chaotic energy to put, you know, channel people in the right direction or what they should believe about something. It bypasses your rational capabilities and you go strictly on emotion. That's something we see all the time, of course, which is also how we try to steer the debate. It isn't really a debate, but the gun control issue in itself, which is, you know, one of the bigger elements. Why don't we just briefly get into that before we, you know, take a break here in a little bit, Sophia. All of this, the main purpose of it, I mean, you go further and wider than gun control, as you said. We'll get into that more later as well, and the testing environment and everything else. But nonetheless, one of the big components here is to get the guns off of Americans, correct?
Well, it seems that way. But bigger than that is that I would say is the Hegelian thing. You create a massacre at a school. And then you tell the people, well, we can't just have guns. We can't let people just have guns. If you look at what happens, they'll take their parents' gun or you get them their own gun and they, you know, it's too much. We have to restrict guns. But really and truly, the public will say, no, don't take our guns. It's in the Constitution. We have the right to be armed and you can't do this. It's against, you know, it's against humanity and freedom. And so they say, okay, we won't take the guns. But we'll just do more mental health evaluations. You just have to pass our evaluations, and then we'll qualify you to have your gun or guns. And later on, you know, we might have to assess you to see if you're fit to be a parent. We might have to assess you every 6 months to see if you can join the Y to exercise. And maybe you won't be able to participate in Little League because you acted out of line with your own kids. So you people have to be in a special Little League and we'll have police officers there. But everything will be increased evaluation. It will be more and more intrusive, more and more questions asked, more and more psych tests taken. And hypotheticals too. Like if you're in the grocery store and the line is too long, what is your first reaction? You leave the store, you complain to somebody, you talk to the person next to you and try to incite anger with everybody that the line is too long. You know, all of these things will be asked about all these what if, and then we'll be categorized this way. And maybe I'll have a green label, you'll have a blue label, and someone else will have a purple label, and it all means something. It predicts our tendencies. So it's all about intrusive surveillance and categorization. There's going to be a bevy of experts that is suddenly going to be on everybody's doorstep taking these questionnaires and giving us the right to have this freedom or that freedom or that other freedom.
Yeah, you're talking about the technology where they can monitor people's, you know, predictable behavior. They're watching the biometric signatures. They have technology or you know, computers that can allegedly even, you know, scan your brain waves to see, you know, what actually is going on in there, etc. This is also on top of things like the child services breathing down your neck, making sure you give your kids the vaccines and, you know, things like that, that you live
right.
in a certain way. Otherwise, if you go outside of that boundary, well, we don't really want you part of our society, correct?
Right. I mean, I was once at an airport, and there was suddenly the need to form another line, and you had to show your driver's license. Well, I showed my driver's license, and the guy says to me, well, now, you be sure to renew your license when it expires.
Yeah.
And I looked and I said, you know what? This is January. My license is going to expire in April. And yes, I'm going to renew it. You don't have to tell me. But you see, this could, in another instance, be taken as the wrong kind of response.
Yeah. It's the... Well, it's very interesting. It's interesting to see that. I mean, we really have that in Sweden already really much in place. There isn't really adults there. It's just they're kind of just wards of the state. They're more like children, really, and they're just, you know, bowing down to authority. And it's I really see that being exported out, and it's very, very disconcerting to me to see that. And it's even gotten to the point where some people even they don't even recognize that they almost laugh at you when you talk about, you know, freedom and individuality and the fact that you want to live your life, that you want to live it. That's like you're obsessed with those ridiculous things. You know, just like they want to be slaves. They don't even just understand those basic ideas. They're like, leave me alone. I'm responsible. I can handle these things on my own. You know, just don't get in my business. That sensitivity is not even there anymore, which is very scary. It really is turning into that, the hive and the snitch culture that you talked about, fitting right into the New World Order plan of the new planned society, right?
Right. And what happened in that airport, Henrik, could have been a test. The responses could have been recorded without our knowledge. They could have gone down somewhere. And then they'll do the same test 3 years later, and they'll see what the average response is. Are people indignant? Are they complacent? Do they say, oh, yes, thank you for reminding me. Oh, yes, I might actually forget, even though it renews on my birthday.
Right.
You know, this is the thing. So without even being aware of it, we're being scripted, 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 scripted all the time.
Yeah. Data collection, they have profiles that have massive storage capabilities on people, and just this basic idea that I think it's very much about social planning, social engineering, and just trying to see, as you say, Sophia, how to harness the masses and the packs and predictability. Because ultimately, I think if this is about controlling what the future is going to be like, just to be in the position where you can, you know, offer that that unrestricted security, if you will, then you need to be able to control those unknown variables fully. I think that's also why part of the dumbing down is going on. The basic things that you don't want to have people, you know, thinking too much out of the box. They have to be really docile, domesticated, kind of predictable creatures, because that really makes sense in the bigger plan, right?
Yes. I'm very, very tempted to do another T-shirt. I swore I would never make any more T-shirts because people have too many T-shirts. They don't want to buy any new ones. But if I
buy ours, no, I'm just kidding. Yeah, go ahead.
Think while it's still legal. That would be what I would put on a T-shirt.
Yeah, thought control.
Think while it's still legal.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
It is pretty funny. Yeah, it's pretty true as well. Well, let's take a little break here. We obviously have much more to discuss here. We've just kind of actually just scraped a little bit on the surface in terms of some of the evidence, but it is really the bigger picture that I'm enjoying speaking with you about as well, kind of where this is going and how you see that this is being used as a situation. But much more, of course, is to come on this. But why don't we give out some of the details? Obviously, I've referred people to the video a number of times. Check it out. Go watch it. See what you think. There's a lot of interesting things in there. Give us your website, Sophia, so people know where to go if they want to find out more. I think you have a DVD version of the presentation as well for sale, right?
Yes. For those who want it, they're welcome to copy it. AvatarProducts.com, AVATAR, AvatarProducts.com. And there is a remake of my video it's the full documentary version that a friend created, and I'm just going to tell you what that is. You can link to it. I think that's probably the best. But it's called Sandy Hook Creating Reality, and my original talk is Unraveling Sandy Hook in 2, 3, 4, and 5 Dimensions. So they're both fun to watch. Haha.
Yeah.
But anyway, they will give you an idea, if you haven't seen this material already, of what we're talking about.
All right. Very good. AvatarProducts.com. Thanks, Sophia, for the first segment. Stay with us. We'll be right back here for our members. Let's listen to a tune here, and then we'll return shortly. We'll be right back. Is to come with Sophia Smallstorm in the second hour as we proceed to discuss Sandy Hook, inconsistencies and anomalies that asks us to consider a different picture than what we've been presented with in the media. We'll talk more about Adam Lanza, creative nonfiction as a means to rewrite history. We talk about Newtown and the connection to the new global religion of the Baha'i Faith. Later we discuss the post-human society and what the bigger picture is and how Newtown and this little quaint experimental town place into the bigger picture. To continue to listen to the second hour, subscribe and get access to our archives of radio programs, videos, films, commentaries, and much more. We have over 800 programs on all kinds of topics, going back to 2006, from esoteric metaphysics to health and geopolitics, and the conspiracy that is history. Check out the archives, browse around, and see what we have for you. By the way, we spare you from commercial interruptions, and websites free from ads. Don't forget to subscribe to our RSS feeds, and of course, as a member, you can comment on our programs as well. RedIceMembers.com, that is the website. Before we proceed, let me tell you what upcoming guests we have. William Mullen on the origins of the Egyptian hieroglyphics and the connection to the ancient sky of plasma and catastrophe. We have John King, Kung Pop Yu Yen, Barbara Peterson, Karen Hudes, Christopher Bolin, and many more coming on the program. We'll be back in just a few days, but we'll proceed for members right now with Sophia Smallstorm. Don't miss it, sign up, and we'll talk to you after the break.